A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one after we did that episode on how blasters are regulated in Israel. You know, the people who handle controlled demolitions, quarry work, that kind of thing. And the weird detail that stuck with both of us was that in Israel, uniquely, getting a blasting license requires a security clearance. Explosives and state secrets all rolled into one license application.
Which is such a strange collision of worlds when you think about it. You're just trying to clear rock for a highway expansion, and suddenly the Shin Bet wants to know about your cousin in Belgium. And not just, does he exist? They want to know what he does, who he works for, whether you talk regularly, whether he's ever asked you about your job. It's the kind of scrutiny most people associate with embassy staff or intelligence analysts, not the guy who's going to bring down an old parking garage.
And that got Daniel asking the bigger question. What actually happens when someone gets security cleared? Not the Hollywood version with the trench coats and the dramatic doorstep interviews, but the real bureaucratic machinery. Who runs it? Is it one central body per country? Or does every agency do its own thing? And what can the rest of us, people doing serious due diligence on hires or business partners, actually learn from how governments vet trust at that level?
This is one of those topics where what most people picture is about 20 years out of date. The reality is far more systematic and, honestly, more interesting than the movie version. The movie version is built for tension. The real version is built for reliability at scale, which means it's designed to be boring on purpose.
It matters now more than you'd think. Because private sector background checks, insider threat programs, even zero-trust security architectures are all quietly borrowing methodology from government clearance processes. The stuff that was built to protect state secrets is trickling down to who gets access to your company's source code. If you're running a fintech startup and you're trying to figure out who should have production database access, you're essentially solving a miniature version of the same problem the Pentagon has been working on since the 50s.
Where do we even start with this? I feel like we need to define terms before we go anywhere else, because most people use security clearance like it's a single badge you either have or you don't.
That's exactly where we should start. What even is one?
Let's start with what a security clearance actually is, because the phrase gets thrown around like it's one thing. It's not. At its core, it's a determination that a person is eligible to access classified information at a specific level. But who makes that determination, how they make it, and what eligible even means? That changes depending on which country you're in, which agency you're dealing with, and which tier of clearance you're after.
It's not like a driver's license where one government body issues it and everyone recognizes it. You can't just flash your clearance card at the CIA and expect them to let you in because the Department of Energy said you were fine.
Exactly the opposite. In the U.S. alone, you've got the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency handling most of the investigations for the Department of Defense. But the CIA runs its own process, the State Department has its own, and the FBI does its own. And those are just the big ones. Each agency can set its own adjudicative standards on top of the baseline. So the DCSA might complete an investigation and hand the file to the CIA. And the CIA's adjudicators can say, thanks for the homework, but we're applying additional criteria and this person doesn't meet our bar.
Which means someone could be cleared by one agency and denied by another for the exact same background.
Happens all the time. And that's before you even cross a border. The UK has three main vetting levels run through UK security vetting, counter-terrorist check, security check, and developed vetting. Canada splits theirs between reliability status and then secret and top secret through the RCMP and CSIS. Australia has four levels, including something called positive vetting, which is their deepest dive. None of these systems recognize each other's clearances automatically. There are reciprocity agreements, but they're limited and specific. A British security check doesn't get you into a SIF in Canberra.
The basic premise of every spy movie where someone says, I have top secret clearance, and doors just open everywhere. That's already fiction.
Your clearance is tied to a specific agency, a specific program, and a specific need-to-know determination. It doesn't travel with you like a passport. You could have a top secret clearance from the Navy and walk into an NSA facility and be told, that's nice, but you don't have need-to-know on this program, so the door stays closed. The clearance gets you eligibility, not access.
I think that distinction, eligibility versus access, is one most people never hear articulated. You can be eligible to see classified material and still never actually see any, because nobody's given you a reason to.
And the other thing movies get wrong is the vibe of the whole thing. Hollywood always makes it feel adversarial. The steely-eyed investigator shows up, asks loaded questions, tries to trip you up. But from everything I've read, the real process is more like an extremely thorough HR onboarding that never really ends. The investigator isn't trying to catch you in a lie for sport. They're trying to establish whether there's anything in your life that someone else could use to compromise you. It's a different orientation entirely.
It's bureaucratic, it's systematic, and it's overwhelmingly document-driven. The SF-86 form in the US, that's the standard questionnaire for national security positions, is 127 pages. It asks for every address you've lived at for the past decade, every foreign contact you've had, every job, every trip abroad. And then they check all of it against databases, credit reports, criminal records, and often interviews with people you listed and people you didn't.
Here's the thing about that 127 pages. It's not just long for the sake of being long. The length is a feature. If you've got nothing to hide, filling it out is tedious but straightforward. If you're trying to conceal something, the cognitive load of maintaining a consistent fabrication across that many fields is genuinely punishing. You have to remember which version of your employment timeline you gave, which foreign trips you disclosed, which address you listed for which year. The form itself is a screening tool before anyone even reads it.
The trench coat and the neighborhood interview do happen, but they're one small piece of a much larger machine.
And increasingly, the machine doesn't stop after the initial investigation. That's the part that would really surprise someone whose mental model is stuck in the Cold War era. The old model was, get investigated, get cleared, and then coast until your periodic reinvestigation comes up. Every 5 years for top secret, every 10 for secret. The gap between those reinvestigations was an acknowledged vulnerability, and everyone in the system knew it. That's where continuous evaluation comes in. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security runs something called the Automated Continuous Evaluation System, ACES, which is basically a near real-time monitoring pipeline. Once you're cleared, the system keeps pulling data from commercial databases, credit bureaus, public records, criminal databases. If you file for bankruptcy on a Tuesday, the system can flag it by Thursday.
Which is a radical shift from the old model, where you got investigated once every 5 or 10 years for a renewal, and everything in between was a blind spot. 5 years is a long time to develop a problem. You could go through a divorce, develop a gambling habit, get into serious debt, and nobody in the security office would have any idea until your reinvestigation came due.
The old model assumed trust was a snapshot. The new model treats it as a live signal. And that's the piece I think is underappreciated. The government figured out that the interval between reinvestigations was the vulnerability. Someone could develop a gambling addiction, get into debt, become a foreign intelligence target, and nobody would know for years. There are real cases where cleared personnel got into financial trouble, self-reported it at their reinvestigation, and the investigator realized the vulnerability had existed for 4 years. 4 years where that person was technically cleared and technically compromised.
What actually triggers a flag? Is it just financial distress? Because that seems like the most automatable one.
Financial is a big one, but it's broader. The adjudicative guidelines, and this is where the U.S. system gets systematic, lay out 13 specific factors that investigators weigh. Allegiance to the United States, foreign influence, foreign preference, sexual behavior, personal conduct, financial considerations, alcohol consumption, drug involvement, psychological conditions, criminal conduct, security violations, outside activities, and misuse of information technology.
That list is fascinating because it's not just a checklist of disqualifiers. The way I understand it, they're weighing guidelines, not hard rules. Having a psychological condition doesn't automatically disqualify you. Having debt doesn't automatically disqualify you. It's all about context and mitigation.
They call it the whole person concept. An investigator looks at the totality of your circumstances. So you might have a DUI from 10 years ago, but if you completed treatment, have been sober since, and disclosed it voluntarily, that's actually viewed differently than hiding a minor financial issue. Mitigating factors matter as much as risk indicators. The DUI shows up, but so does the decade of clean behavior after it. The system is designed to weigh both sides of the scale.
Which is where the human interview still plays a role that databases can't replace. The form gives them the map, the databases give them the terrain, but the interview is where they test whether you're being honest about what's on both. A database can tell you someone filed for bankruptcy. It can't tell you whether they're being candid about why.
That's the part Hollywood sort of gets right, even if they dramatize it. Investigators do talk to your references, your neighbors, your coworkers, but it's structured. They're not just asking, is he a good guy? They're corroborating specific details you provided and looking for inconsistencies. If you said you left a job in March and your former boss says February, that's noted. One discrepancy might be nothing. People misremember dates all the time. A pattern of discrepancies becomes a problem. Three different references remember? Three different timelines for the same event? Now you've got a signal.
I'd imagine the investigator isn't just noting the discrepancy itself, but how the subject reacts when it's pointed out. Do they get defensive? Do they have a reasonable explanation? Do they suddenly change their story?
The interview is a dynamic thing. It's not just collecting answers. It's observing how those answers are delivered, whether they hold up under follow-up, whether the person volunteers information or only surrenders it when cornered. That's the part no database can replicate.
Now the Israeli model Daniel's prompt got us thinking about. That's where this whole thing started. Is unusual. In most countries, security clearance is tied to a position. You need it for a specific job, and if you leave that job, the clearance goes dormant. In Israel, for certain professions like blasting, the clearance is tied to the professional license itself. It's not, you need clearance because you work on this base. It's you need clearance because you handle explosives, period, regardless of employer.
Which makes a certain kind of sense when you think about it. A blaster has access to commercial explosives, which are themselves a security concern. So the Shin Bet, Israel's internal security service, often conducts the vetting directly, not some separate personnel security agency. It's a much tighter coupling between the security service and the licensing body. The logic is, if you're going to give someone access to things that go boom, we want to know who they are, and we want the people who do counterintelligence for a living to be the ones making that call.
That creates a bottleneck, which you mentioned in the blaster episode. There's literally a shortage of licensed blasters in Israel right now, partly because the clearance process is slow. You've got construction projects waiting on people who are waiting on the Shin Bet, and there's no way to speed it up because the security service isn't going to cut corners on vetting someone who handles explosives.
The UK system takes a different approach. Their developed vetting, which is the deepest level, includes a detailed interview about your personal life, finances, and any vulnerabilities that could be exploited. They're explicitly looking for pressure points, not necessarily problems you've caused, but things that could be used to pressure you. Gambling debt, an affair, a family member in a hostile country. The question isn't, have you done something wrong? It's, if someone wanted to lean on you, what would they use?
That pressure point framing is actually a useful lens for any kind of due diligence. You're not just asking, has this person done something wrong? You're asking what could be used to compromise this person. And those are overlapping but distinct questions. Someone can be ethically spotless and still be highly compromisable because of circumstances they didn't choose. A sibling in a difficult jurisdiction, a medical debt they're ashamed of, a personal situation they don't want disclosed.
That's the thread we should pull next, what the rest of us can actually take from how governments do this. Because that pressure point lens is portable in a way that a 127-page form isn't. That pressure point lens, what could be used to compromise this person? That's the piece most private sector background checks completely miss. A typical corporate vetting for a C-suite hire checks criminal records, verifies employment history, maybe runs a credit report. But it's almost entirely backward-looking. Did you do something wrong in the past? The government approach flips that. It asks, What in your life right now could be weaponized against you?
Which is a fundamentally different question, and it's one you can actually operationalize without a security service budget. If you're bringing on a partner who'll have access to your company's financial accounts, you should be asking about foreign business ties, the same way an adjudicator would look at the foreign influence guideline. Not because foreign ties are inherently suspicious, but because they create competing pressures that a purely domestic background check would never surface.
There's a real case that illustrates this perfectly. A defense contractor had a cleared employee married to a foreign national whose family ran a manufacturing business overseas. Nothing illegal, no espionage. But the business had ties to a state-owned enterprise in a country the U.S. considers a counterintelligence concern. The contractor lost his clearance, not because he did anything wrong, but because the financial entanglement created a pressure point that couldn't be mitigated. The concern wasn't that he was a spy. The concern was that if someone wanted to apply pressure, they had a lever.
In a corporate context, most companies would never catch that. They'd verify the guy's resume, check for a criminal record, and call it done. They wouldn't even know to look at the spouse's business relationships. And even if they somehow stumbled across the information, they wouldn't have a framework for evaluating what it means. They'd just see married to a foreign national and either panic or shrug, with no structured way to assess the actual risk.
That's where the adjudicative guidelines become a practical template. You don't need all 13, but 3 of them translate directly to business due diligence. Financial considerations. Is this person under pressure that might make them cut corners or sell access? Foreign influence. Do they have ties that create competing loyalties? Personal conduct. Is there a pattern of rule bending or dishonesty that doesn't rise to a criminal record but still signals risk?
The whole person concept is what stops this from becoming a mechanical checklist that generates false positives. A single foreign contact isn't disqualifying. A single late payment isn't either. What investigators are trained to spot is the pattern. The combination of financial strain, plus undisclosed foreign ties, plus evasiveness in interviews. That constellation matters more than any one data point. It's the difference between this person has a cousin in another country, and this person has a cousin in another country, didn't disclose it, got defensive when asked, and also has unexplained deposits.
Which brings us to what Hollywood actually gets right and wrong, because I think this is where people's intuitions are most miscalibrated. The movies show an investigator showing up at your childhood home, questioning your elderly neighbor, maybe digging through your trash. And the truth is, investigators do conduct field interviews. They talk to references, co-workers, former landlords. But it's structured, it's recorded, and it's part of a formal suitability determination, not some rogue agent building a secret dossier. The investigator has a checklist. They're filling out a report. It's going into a file that will be reviewed by adjudicators who are not in the room.
The trench coat exists, but it's filling out a form afterward. It's less. I'll ask the questions here and more. I need to verify paragraph 7, subsection 3, and then I have 3 more interviews before lunch.
And what Hollywood almost never shows is the sheer volume of paperwork. The SF-86 isn't just long, it's intentionally exhaustive. Every foreign trip, every foreign contact, every side business, every address. The form itself is a stress test. If you're trying to hide something, the burden of maintaining a consistent fabrication across 127 pages is enormous. Most people who try to lie on these forms don't get caught because an investigator spotted the lie. They get caught because they contradicted themselves on page 94 from something they wrote on page 12.
That's a design feature, not a bug. The opacity paradox, and I think this is one of the most interesting things about the whole system, is that the guidelines are public. Anyone can download the adjudicative desk reference and read exactly what investigators weigh. The 13 factors, the mitigating conditions, the whole framework, it's all published. But the specific reasoning for any individual denial is almost never disclosed.
That's deliberate. If you told every applicant exactly what triggered their denial, you'd be handing a how-to guide to the next person trying to game the system. The opacity protects the process. But it also means legitimate applicants sometimes walk away with no idea what went wrong, which is frustrating if you're on the receiving end. You can be denied a clearance, lose a job opportunity, and never learn whether it was something you did, something a reference said, or something in your financial history you'd forgotten about entirely.
I'd imagine that's especially maddening because some of the things that trigger denials aren't even things the applicant knows about. A reference says something inconsistent. A neighbor mentions something offhand. A database flags an address you forgot you lived at. You walk away thinking you failed some test when really the system just accumulated enough small discrepancies to cross a threshold.
That's the double-edged sword of the whole person concept. It's more fair in aggregate because it doesn't disqualify you for one mistake, but it's also more opaque because the reasoning is inherently holistic. There's no single checkbox you can point to and say, "That's why I failed."
What's the practical takeaway for someone doing their own due diligence? You don't need a 127-page form, but you do need structure. The government's insight is that trustworthiness isn't a single attribute you can measure with one check. It's a composite signal built from multiple independent sources that either corroborate or contradict each other. A credit report tells you one thing, references tell you another, public records tell you a third. If they all point in the same direction, you've got a signal. If they conflict, you got a different kind of signal.
That corroboration chain idea is something anyone can adopt. When you check references, don't just call the three people the candidate gave you. Ask each reference who else knows the candidate well, then call those people too. If the story stays consistent across 4 degrees of separation, that's a signal. If it starts to fray, that's also a signal. The government calls this developed references, references you get from other references, not from the subject. It's one of the simplest and most effective techniques in the whole process, and almost nobody in the private sector does it.
It's so simple, but it completely changes the information you get. The references someone hands you are curated. They're the people who will say nice things. The references of references are much harder to curate. You might end up talking to someone who worked with the candidate 3 jobs ago and has a very different perspective.
The continuous evaluation piece is harder to replicate without government-scale data access, but the mindset translates. Don't treat a background check as a one-time gate. Set up alerts for things you can monitor: court filings, bankruptcy announcements, regulatory actions. The point isn't to spy on people, it's to recognize that trustworthiness isn't static. Someone who was low risk last year might not be this year. A CFO who was financially stable when you hired them might be going through a divorce and facing pressure they didn't have before. That doesn't make them a bad person, it makes them a different risk profile than the one you originally assessed.
This is where I think the government model and the corporate model are converging. The old corporate approach was check the boxes, hire the person, and unless they get arrested, assume everything's fine. The new approach, borrowed directly from continuous evaluation, is trust, but maintains signal awareness. You're not actively investigating your employees, but you're not willfully blind to changes in their circumstances either.
If you're actually trying to operationalize this, and I think that's what Daniel's really asking, you can boil it down to 3 things you could start doing tomorrow. First, steal the adjudicative guidelines framework. You don't need all 13 factors, but financial stability, foreign influence, and personal conduct are the ones that map directly onto business risk. If someone has undisclosed debt, business ties in jurisdictions you can't verify, or a pattern of cutting ethical corners, those are your red flags. The framework just gives you permission to look at the whole picture instead of checking boxes.
Second is the continuous evaluation mindset. Most due diligence is a snapshot. You check someone before you hire them or sign a contract, and then you never look again. But the government learned the hard way that the gap between checks is where the risk lives. You can set up basic monitoring without being creepy. Court record alerts, regulatory filings, news mentions. It's not about distrust. It's about recognizing that circumstances change.
The third one is the one I think is most undervalued, the corroboration chain. Don't just call the references someone hands you. Ask each reference for 2 more people who know the candidate well, then call those people. The government does this systematically. If the story holds across 6 degrees of separation, that's meaningful. If it starts wobbling at step 2, that's also meaningful. And the beauty of it is that it costs you nothing but time. You don't need a database subscription. You just need to ask who else should I talk to, and then actually follow up.
The through line in all 3 of these is that security clearance processes aren't magic. They're not some dark art practiced by spy agencies behind closed doors. They're systematic, they're repeatable, and the core logic, gather independent signals, weigh them holistically, keep monitoring, is completely adaptable to how you'd vet a business partner, a key hire, or even a vendor with access to sensitive systems. The government just has more databases and a bigger budget. The logic is the same.
I think the thing that surprises people most when they actually look at how this works is how unglamorous the whole thing is. There's no secret formula. It's just thoroughness applied consistently over time. The government isn't doing anything a particularly diligent private investigator couldn't do. They're just doing it at scale, with better data access and without cutting corners when it gets tedious.
One thing I keep turning over, and I think this is where this is all heading, is whether the human interview eventually becomes obsolete. If continuous evaluation systems are already pulling financial data, travel records, public filings in near real time, an AI can cross-reference all of that against 127 pages of disclosures. What's left for the investigator to actually do? At some point, the machine is going to be better at spotting inconsistencies than a human who's done 4 interviews that day and is running on coffee.
I've thought about this a lot, and I'm not sure the interview ever goes away entirely, because what the interview tests isn't just factual accuracy, it's honesty under pressure. A database can tell you someone went to Prague in March. It can't tell you whether they're being forthcoming about who they met there. The human interaction is still the best tool we have for detecting evasion. Not because humans are magical lie detectors, but because the experience of being questioned by another human being creates a different kind of pressure than filling out a form. Most people can lie to a PDF. Fewer people can lie smoothly to a patient investigator who keeps asking follow-up questions.
The line is definitely blurring. The thing that struck me researching this is how much private sector insider threat programs are already converging with government clearance methodology. Zero trust architectures treat every access request as suspect until verified. That's not that different from continuous evaluation, treating every cleared person as potentially compromised until the data says otherwise. The philosophical shift is the same. Trust isn't the status you earn once, it's a hypothesis you keep testing.
The implication is that the distinction between government cleared and corporate vetted might not mean as much in 10 years as it does now. The tools are converging. The frameworks are converging. What the NSA does to monitor its cleared personnel, and what a bank does to monitor its traders. Those processes are starting to look eerily similar. Both are pulling real-time data feeds. Both are looking for anomalies. Both are using the same underlying logic of continuous signal monitoring.
The real takeaway is simpler than all the bureaucracy makes it seem. Governments have spent decades building systems to answer one question. Can this person be trusted with something sensitive? And the answer is never a single data point. It's a process, it's systematic, it's ongoing, and anyone can borrow that logic. You might not have access to classified databases, but you can adopt the mindset, multiple independent signals, weighed holistically, monitored over time.
That's where I'd leave it. The next time you see a movie where someone gets cleared in a dramatic 5-minute interview, you'll know the truth is both more boring and more interesting. Boring because it's mostly paperwork and database queries. Interesting because it's actually a remarkably thoughtful framework for answering a question that matters to all of us, whether we're protecting state secrets or just trying to figure out who should have the keys to the kingdom.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In Greenland, an extinct Inuit Sign Language dialect known as East Greenlandic Sign Language was used by approximately 30 to 40 deaf individuals within isolated coastal communities, functioning as a fully independent language unrelated to Danish Sign Language before its last fluent users passed away without documentation.
30 to 40 people, whole language, gone. I'm stuck on the without documentation part. Nobody wrote down how it worked, nobody recorded it. It just existed in the hands and faces of a few dozen people in coastal Greenland, and then it didn't.
That's the thing about small languages. They're incredibly fragile. One generation doesn't pass it on, and it's just an entire way of structuring thought gone.
That one's going to sit with me.
Our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, everybody. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry. I'm Korn. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.